This is Beyond the Wall, a Game of Thrones LCG podcast brought to you by Istril and Darknotch. We'd like to thank Fantasy Flight Games for our hobby and their continued support, Drew Dallas at Card Game DB for our hosting, and the AGOT community as a whole for making this possible. Let us take you beyond the wall.
Welcome to another episode of Beyond the Wall. Today we'll have a very brief introduction segment to go over some FFG news, after which we're going to talk to the Joust World Champion. And then we're going to talk a little bit about Alex and Vapehead's Targ Black Sails deck. And then we'll have, of course, our closing comments.
All right, John, this is episode 43, and this is the before-last episode we have of Season 1. And boy, has there been a lot of news over the weekend and last week.
There has. There's been a lot of big tournaments.
A lot of big tournaments? One massive tournament.
Oh, well. Okay. There's been one massive tournament that had a lot of big events.
A lot of big events. So, right. What news do you have out of the event, or out of the events?
Well, I think the most important thing is that the big underwear. I think that's what we're going to refer to him now, just the big underwear. One Mealy at Shalik.
So he's guest of the cast, a good friend of the cast. That's Jakob Hultman or Jakob on the boards. He was actually wearing a shirt that said Giant Underwear on the back and had a little Swedish flag on the side. That's basically like wearing a Beyond the Wall endorsement.
I was pretty excited. NASCAR.
Players are basically putting Beyond the Wall on their shirts for no money, I guess.
Basically.
That melee ended at like 2:30, 3 in the morning on the first night. And, I mean, that surely, an epic affair. That was won by Targ, Knights of the Hollow Hill. I think that may be Hollow Hill's first big melee win. Not its first final table. I mean,
no, it's been final table several times. Yeah,
exactly. But then the Joust was a 209-person affair that was played all in one day, technically, and that nobody got to go to bed, but it ended at 5 in the morning the following day. And that was won by a Dutchman called Don Van Beek. And he's not a player I've heard of before. He was playing Baron No Agenda in a mirror match in the final against Laplante from France, who was at Worlds. He was getting his friend playing a Baron No Agenda as well.
Yep.
So players performing well on both sides of the ocean with a deck that is still very well suited to the current meta.
And it's just a very strong deck.
The overall in the end went to Andreas from Sweden, who had made the final table in Melee and made the cut, and I think the top 16, maybe even the top 8. Unfortunately, the stats are still a little finicky coming out of Stalik. So the Swedish took both the Melee Championship and the overall championship from Stalik this year from a meta that nobody had heard of last year.
And they did well in the team event.
England took the team event in the end. I'm not entirely sure how the team event went. So I saw the challenge update, which was live updated with which teams were in the loser's bracket and so on. But my understanding is it's the top three or the top four players placing in the Joust took the same decks the next day and then paired off against other countries that also had four players?
Yes, that's my understanding as well.
Mm-hmm. And they gradually made their way, and eventually England won. So England prevails, I guess. But Stalik isn't the only news, and obviously, I mean, Stalik is massive news, but we're going to dedicate all of next week to it. Definitely hoping to get some interesting guests on for that. It's a tournament like no other. We had reports coming in from a few scattered Twitter feeds, but there's no good wireless there, so there's still a lot of news to come out of that tournament. However, we'll dedicate that to next week. There's a big item of FFG news this week, which was the merger with Asmodee. The merger. I don't know much about mergers. I don't know much about how these companies work. Asmodee is a company that's apparently very, very big. But I hadn't heard of them until recently when they bought out Days of Wonder that makes, for instance, Ticket to Ride. And now they've got this acquisition of FFG. You know, it's impossible to predict how that's going to affect things. The press release is PR and says, all your games will be fine. distribution in Europe will be better because and distribution in China will be better because we have head offices there. You know, I have no idea what that actually means for the game.
Yeah, I have no idea either. I mean, I think it's too early to really draw any conclusions, and they really seem to try to spin it as not an acquisition, but, you know, a joining of forces.
Yeah. One of the things that I did upon hearing about this, because I'm not sure whether the press release means anything for us as consumers, really. They're not chock full of information. There is a nice interview with Christian Peterson on Board Game Geek, which I will try to link as well. But I asked a couple FFG employees that I've been in contact with if the merger was good for them, or, you know, if this is a problem for them. And unanimously they said that it opens up a lot of doors, that it's a very good thing for them. So if it's good for the employees, then it's fine by me.
Yeah, I have to agree with that.
What else? Before we jump into this episode, there's one more thing I wanted to, or two more things. The first is that the stats from Worlds began to pour in last week, so I finally updated the annals to include all of the houses by standing. I'm still missing Agenda and Restricted. Those are coming early this week. And the other thing is that Kid sent me his deck, and it was updated in the comments of last week's episode. So if you were waiting a couple of days for that, a couple of days ago I got that in, so you guys can recreate the Melee final. And then, so what do we have planned for today, John?
Well, today we're going to basically talk about the Joust day, and we're going to talk a little about the deck that you and Stroms played, and we're going to talk to the Joust champion.
Except, arbitrarily, I decided to put it in the other order, so we'll do the Joust champion first, and then the deck.
Perfect.
All right. So we're joined by someone who actually started before this recording as desperately hoping that people would not realize he was a good player. This seems to be a Wisconsin thing.
Maybe.
No comment.
I don't want to represent Wisconsin as a whole, so.
But he is also the current Joust world champion. So you must all know who we're talking about, right? Why don't you introduce yourself?
My name is Samuel Bratz. I guess I'm the current Joust world champion.
You guess? You're not sure? The playmat doesn't say world champion.
It's been like a couple weeks and it still hasn't really set in yet, so.
Yeah, my hammer only arrived yesterday and it still sort of stares at me as if I didn't deserve it.
Yeah. Should not be confused with the overall world champ, Alexander Hines.
It rarely is. The Joust champion gets considerably more credit. The overall champion didn't actually win any events. So, Sam, if I recall correctly, you have a background in other card games primarily, right?
Yeah, I play a lot of Magic. I still do way more than like Thrones or any of the other LCGs, I guess.
So at what level do you play Magic, out of curiosity?
I travel a lot. I mean, I'll go to most of the Midwest events and like the GPs and the PTQs, if those acronyms mean anything to anyone.
So you've ever won a Grand Prix or anything like that?
No. I haven't had anywhere near the success that I have in Thrones, despite spending way more time doing it. So.
And probably way more money.
So how long have you been playing Thrones?
It's kind of tough to gauge. I mean, I've known how to play since all the people in my playtest group have known, so it's probably been 4 or 5 years now. But I definitely haven't actually tried to prepare for a tournament in my whole life until Worlds. So,
did you really prepare for that?
We actually tried to, like, play games, which normally doesn't happen. So like, every week we'd probably play, I don't know, at least once a week we'd try to get some games in. So that was definitely the first time I've ever actually tried doing that.
So who is we in this case?
We is me, Chad Baumgart, Dan, Kid Seafelt, a couple other people that aren't recognizable names, so I assume the first two are. But
yeah, those two are big names.
Those two are big names. So you've got great testing partners, and now you've proven that you're better than either of them.
Yes.
Whoa. Kid has a couple cards.
Oh, that's true. You still need 2 more card designs.
Kid is 3 times better than me, according to card metrics.
Excellent. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about the tournament preparation then. Were there a lot of different decks you guys were trying, or had you guys settled on a deck fairly early on?
I guess we're kind of like an offshoot of the DC meta. So we had decks going in that people thought were good. I tried to build decks for a long time. I had a Clansman deck and a Longship Iron Wind deck and a lot of other fun stuff, but most of them just turned out to be too bad to actually play. So,
So you had settled then on the Darkwing's Dark Words fairly early, or was that...
No, actually. So tournament was on Friday, but Thursday night I was going to play my Longship Ironwind House of Dreams deck. Like, I was dead set on it, and then I played a game and just got utterly crushed, and I just decided to play the other deck that Chad had with him, which was the Darkwing's Dark Words Lanny deck. So I had actually never played a single game with it before the tournament.
Now, you told me a story, which I absolutely love, so I'd ask you to repeat it, about your last card choice for the deck.
Oh, yeah, I did. I guess I did have some deck-building decisions. So we couldn't find a second Harrenhal for the deck, and I didn't really want to spend time looking for it or buy the chapter pack. So I just said that there was a face-down proxy, just another Thrones card, and I said, if this card is any good, I'm just going to play it as my 75th card. And it was a Wealth of the Rock, and I was like, this seems like a good event, so I'll just play that instead.
That's deck building at its finest, I gotta say.
True craftsmanship.
So obviously you said that you didn't build the deck. Who did?
Corey did. Faraday.
Probably one of the best deck builders in the world, so I mean,
it was definitely a good deck. I will give it a lot of credit.
Yeah, well, there were a lot of people playing that deck, and not all of them made the cut, so...
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, so there's a little credit to you, and I mean, you beat Alex Hines. I hear he's good at Thrones. And you beat a lot of other great players, like the ex-world champion, for instance, in the final match.
Yep, I actually beat him in the Swiss, too. So
that's right, cool. Chris lost in the Swiss as well. Yeah.
That's pretty significant. I mean, it's obviously not just the deck, it's the pilot that makes the difference. Congratulations on that.
Thank you, I appreciate it.
So can you tell us a little bit about the deck and how, you know, some of its favorable matchups, its bad matchups, what the deck is trying to do? Because one of the complaints that people have often said when playing Darkwing's Dark Words is they say that it's a high-variance deck, and I actually found in facing that deck a couple of times and in seeing it in action that it's actually extremely high redundancy and an extremely low-variance deck. Can you give us any thoughts?
I mean, the strength of this version, it played the River Plot. Crossing the Mummers Ford was the restricted card. There's a lot of one-ofs, but a lot of the events are somewhat redundant because they're going to kneel a guy or make something irrelevant in combat. So they pretty much all do the same thing, and you just draw so many cards over the course of the game. Once you start with your crossing and you copy that, and then you Under the Bridge of Dreams it again, and you just get 5, 6, 7, and 8 card turns, you're going to find what you need eventually, and it's not really hard to just close the game out after that.
Well, that was one of the things. So people were commenting on the final match, and they go, oh, I can't believe he had this event in hand. It's one copy in 75. And I pointed out to them, well, it wouldn't have mattered if it was a Secret Orders or a Harry the Riverland or a You Killed the Wrong Dwarf. Or all of those are going to negate that challenge, right?
Mm-hmm. And, like, it's not like I flopped amazing in the final game. I think we both flopped 3 cards, so obviously it was good to have something that knelt it, but I could have just easily flopped 5 cards or had one of the 7 other Neil events that actually did something too, so...
You did quite well in the Swiss. You only had 2 losses. Those were your only 2 losses, period. Want to tell us a little bit about those humbling or learning experiences?
Sure. My loss to a Siege of Winterfell deck, which I think ended up top 16. I think you beat it, actually, in the top 16.
Kills?
Yeah, that sounds right.
Oh, I got lucky in beating that. That was
it was an interesting deck. Like,
I think Siege was a good call in the meta. I mean,
Did you play that, too?
I played Siege as well.
I played Siege, so yeah, I'm not going to... And, I mean, the same Siege that I played was the one that Aaron played. He made top 16. I'm pretty sure if I didn't have a fever that day, I would have been all right. Yeah, so I think Siege was a good meta call, and I think, yeah, maybe it was one of the few bad matchups for that deck you had.
Yeah, the game was pretty interesting. It ended up actually coming down. He needed to draw a character. He had no cards in hand, so he needed to draw 2 characters. I knew there was the stalwart guy. Kyle Condon,
yeah,
I think.
Kyle Condon.
So I knew he had that on top, and he needed to draw a second one to actually, like, close the game out before I won, because I think we both had, like, 12 power or something somehow at that point. So it was actually a pretty close game. I mean, the strength of Darkwing's Dark Words is you can always draw the events you need to beat pretty much anyone, I think, in the long run, but sometimes you don't, so.
And your second and only other loss?
It was to, actually, your deck. Not you piloting it.
Unfortunately. Dave Stroms, yeah.
Yes.
Right.
That one, I mean, he flopped 6 cards. I guess, like, the Black Sails decks, if they get to go into their hold the first turn, it seems like they can put enough pressure on you to close the game out early.
But I heard that as long as you remember, that's good.
Come on, rub it in, John. Rub it in.
Remember, your agenda has a text box. It's generally a good thing to do.
I think that goes for pretty much every agenda.
Yes.
But I also hear if you play the right plot that you wanted to choose is good too. So I mean, I can't say too much.
Yeah. They're picking the wrong three gold plot, John.
What's that?
John thought he was flipping into First Snow Winter or into March to the Wall and accidentally.
No. I thought it was First Snow, and I flipped into March and marched my own three cost character off the board because I hear it's good to start the game with no characters instead of returning all your opponent's characters to hand.
Yeah, then you can Valor and you don't lose anything.
Yeah, that was my whole plan.
Except he wasn't running Valor.
Yeah.
Well, he was better. Like, they won't commit any more characters to the board.
Never see it coming.
They'll never see it coming. Out of curiosity, because they haven't done this before, this was the first time that they've done Worlds over 2 days. What was your day one end like? Were you preparing for day two? Were you passing out? Were you pacing the room with adrenaline?
Were you doing shots and doing boat races with the rest of the DC meta?
No boat races. There is some drinking, but we went out to whatever that bar is.
Joe Sensors.
Yeah. Had some drinks. Honestly, I was just shocked to be there. Like, when we made the cut to the top 32, I was pretty pumped and beat it. Like, actually winning that first game was just huge for me because it gave me some confidence because I've never been up there, especially in Thrones.
Good. You said you've been playing Thrones for quite some time, but you had never prepared for an event like this. Why exactly did you decide to prepare for this event, and why hadn't you before? What had kept you out of the game, and what drew you in this time?
I guess, like, I played in Worlds last year with pretty much no experience under my belt, and it was a good time, so I knew I was going to be coming to Worlds again. After I played in Gen Con 2 just in the Joust, because I had no experience with Melee and didn't really have any drive to play it in the first place, but I really enjoyed that experience. And like, I mean, there's obviously good players that I play with, and they don't play enough, so it was kind of me stepping up to make them play more initially.
So you did it to help your friends, and what really happened was your friends helped you.
Yes, I guess
to refine the game. I mean, that's the pinnacle of a good meta, where you have a
it's karma.
Lot of
that's
really,
it's good.
Yeah, karma's good. Do you have any memorable matches during the tournament? The ones that you think were just really cool? You talked a little bit about your Siege match, but was there maybe a particular match that was really different or interesting or fun, whatever?
My round two opponent, he was playing like a Vera Martell power rushy kind of deck. I don't know if it has an actual archetype.
Was it
with it
Martell Conquest to Vera?
Yes, it was.
Martathian.
Sure. Martathian. We've had a fight about this name for ages.
But yeah, so that game was interesting because I kept him pretty well under control. Like, he didn't, I mean, I think he got up to like 12 power at one point or something around those levels, but he had no cards in hand and didn't really have a board state. And I was also at about like similar power levels. And what happened was he had one card in hand. I made a intrigue challenge with Janos Slint and Yezin's Grotesquery. I think I didn't need to do it with both, but I just wanted to draw a card with the Janos Slint. And he ended up having that Martell event that if you lose a challenge by four or more, you get to, like, blank everyone's icons.
Yeah, Piper's Rage.
Yes, and so he had three renowned guys. I had no icons, and he had, like, 10 to 12 power, and, like, could clearly just win, and I had no ways to get around it. So I had to draw a card with my agenda off of I'm Urit Small. Like, didn't do anything, it just drew a card. He declared a power challenge with all of his guys, I think, and I top decked into the only game that matters, and he had no intrigue icons between them.
Beautiful.
So he also, I think it ended up that he had 14 power, and he Valored to try to kill my Zolo. So like he had 14 power, and he was going to Valor to kill my Zolo, and I had Crossing the Ruby Ford was the plot that I played to take one power off his house. So that was pretty interesting.
Beautiful.
Yeah, that sounds awesome.
So you do know that if you only had one card in hand, you could have never played that event against
yes,
you.
Yeah, we figured that out afterwards.
Okay. Details.
Details.
Like, that doesn't work at all. And I was like, oh, well, it sounded cool. So
You won anyway, so it wasn't a big deal.
All right, well, so you climbed all the way to the top. Your final match was, in fact, your semifinal match and your final match were on camera, so people can have a look at it. Is there a card in your deck that you would say was an MVP? Not Johnny Crossing the Mummers Ford, because that's too easy.
Yes. In my top four match, the misinformation was just absolutely insane. It won a two-claim challenge with a Lannisport Moneylender versus five strength, and it was just absolutely disgusting and completely turned the tempo of the game. So that was probably, like, my favorite play of the whole day. So I guess I got to give props to misinformation.
What do you think of the Grotesquerie? I mean, this is a card that a lot of people don't put in their decks, but I actually love. How did it play out for you?
Drew it a couple times, and it was pretty strong. It definitely manipulates combat in your favor sometimes, especially, I mean, there's so many things that people have to play around when they're playing against the deck that just another added board element can sometimes just screw with them.
And so having won, this means that you get a champ card design and official recognition and all these other things. It also means that unlike some previous winners from Wisconsin, like, say, Tim Peterson, Gen Con 2013, you're not allowed to fall off the face of the earth. You got to stick around with the Thrones community.
Correct. Tim actually lives in the same city I do, so.
So you better go kick him.
That's right.
I've never met him. I don't really know.
That's okay. We can get his home address, and you just show up and just kick him and be like, that's where he got, and walk away.
I'm sure no one minds.
Yeah, will you be fine.
Will you be playing come next year, or are you looking forward to the reboot?
I don't own a single Thrones card besides the ones that you gave me and the promotional cards that I received at the past two Worlds. So I am probably the case study on why 2.0 is important for the game.
That's awesome.
So you expect to be jumping in with 2.0?
Yeah, yes, I will definitely be doing so, and I'll be doing my best to kind of promote the game around to our community. We have a lot of Netrunner players and Star Wars and all those other LCGs, so I think it'll be a good jumping point for all the people that don't currently play Thrones 2.
So you want a card design. You'll be designing a card for 2.0. Do you have ideas yet?
I have some, but now that there's the whole new card pool, it's definitely going to – I'm going to have to wait and see what's coming out. And
yeah, it's hard to judge your power level or anything like that, right? So to find a card that finds a niche, you need to know what exists out there. Yeah.
My initial thought was to make an agenda or maybe just a plot that gave you an extra dominance phase at the start of the turn, so you could play all those fun events that require a dominance phase to play.
Okay, someone at Worlds came up to me and said, Sam's got an idea for a card, and the way his card would work is a plot that made all the phases go backwards.
Yes, that was my second idea.
I thought that was kind of interesting, and I could see that from a Magic player point of view, because when I played Magic, it was in the very first, you know, Alpha, Beta, and Arabian Nights, and all the way up to Urza. And at that time, we had a lot of cards.
Anyway.
We had a lot of cards that modified other cards. Like, I think it was Magical Hack, where you would change the color on the card, and another one would change the name. And I thought, that's such a Magic player thing to just changed the whole entire plot sequence, but at the same time, it's cool.
So yeah, I think it would maybe be too good, just because it's essentially like a Fear of Winter, where if you're ahead, you just get to murder them in combat again, and there's a bunch of
marshaling,
and you get to lock a plot down as well, right?
Yes,
you won't get. I don't know.
I didn't really think a whole lot about like the technical details, but you also skip taxation and you skip standing, so.
Well, you do them, it's just at the beginning.
Yeah, I mean, it's just
nothing.
Yeah,
that's interesting. So, you said you came from a background of Magic. Are there any specific things that you would say Magic really helped you prepare for the transition to Thrones? Because in some ways, they're very different games for the attrition of characters, for the timing, for mana pools, for the way that goes. But is it the competitive scene is similar enough? Or?
I think the competitive scene is actually a lot different. I mean, every person I met at the Thrones tournaments have just been very good people. And like, I'm not saying the Magic players are bad people, but you don't really get invested in your opponents at all. A lot of the people I played with, I went out with for a drink the night after and stuff like that. So I think that the community is definitely a lot nicer. I mean, it's smaller too, so I guess that might have something to do with it. But
I have to hope as the community booms with Thrones 2.0 that we can keep it the kind of community where we fill up two boxes instead of one.
Yeah, I mean, Joe Sensors was amazing. It was 80% Thrones players. I was looking around. I don't see any Netrunner guys, no Star Wars guys. It's a great community. Definitely.
Yeah, sure. I definitely appreciate it. As for, like, Magic skills that transferred, I don't know. I think the games are actually a lot more similar than you would think. I mean, there's a lot more combat math, like onboard combat math in Thrones as opposed to Magic. And there's a lot more, like, I guess, instant speed tricks and stuff in Magic versus Thrones. But the general concepts are just exactly the same, honestly.
So you just got to pick the card game with a better community.
Right.
All right.
Well, I mean, unless you're trying to make money, and then you better pick Magic. So we talked about the World Champions tournament. Why don't you tell us a little about yours, Alex?
About my tournament?
Yeah. You did all right, I hear.
I did do all right. I emerged from the Swiss undefeated. I built my deck, and we talked about it a little bit with Stroms. It'll be in this episode as well. As a sort of meta answer to Bera, I never faced Bera at all. I just kept getting paired up against other Targs, and that worked out fairly well for me overall, because it turns out I underestimated the Bera decks. I think getting Boingyi, the French champion's deck, probably was a good matchup against mine rather than a favorable matchup for me, which I thought it was. Yeah, I emerged undefeated from the Swiss. I was really excited about that. My first matchup was against Dan, so I knew that the overall was on the line against Kid Seafelt, because he had finished first at the melee table. So whoever won that matchup had a really good chance at overall, and that matchup definitely went my way. And then I found out that my next match was going to be against Siege, which is basically my worst matchup. I slept about 2 hours, woke up early, and then woke John up so that we could practice the Siege matchup for a couple hours. He beat me 5 out of 6 times. I figured my tournament was just going to end there, and then I drew a perfect starting hand to beat that Siege deck and waltzed on through it, and then my day ended facing a young upstart, soon-to-be world champion.
I mean, it's nothing better than saying that, well, I lost a game, only one game the whole time, and it was to the world champion.
Yeah, no, I'm pretty pleased with it.
Really interesting matches. I got to play Kyle Wenzel from 2C1C.
Oh, so and I beat him.
Oh. I kind of beat him, but then I lost.
Let's see.
It's that other podcast. It's not very good. Don't worry about it.
Okay.
But when I was playing Kyle, he asked for me to wait a second. He went to go talk to Nate French. And when he came back, this was just prior to the plot phase, he felt confident in something. We both flipped our plots, and he had flipped over Valor Morghulis. And once the boards were cleared, I was in a pretty good position at this point in the game. And I had flipped Dry Season. He tried to use Call the Three-Eyed Crow to bring Mira back onto the board and then into Shadows. And his logic was basically that he'd be able to have Mira safe in Shadows. I'd probably go first. I'd do some military challenges, and whatever he felt like, he could pop Mira back out, and, you know, he'd have some board presence for the following turn. But when I explained to him that he couldn't do that, he was very sad, we'll say, especially since he said that what he had just talked to Nate about was the fact that he could do that. And I said, I'm going to have to call over a judge. So I did, and Nate came back over, and he said, no, that's not exactly what he said, and it's true that because she was in Morbid, she cannot go into Shadows. And Kyle was like, well, then I lose the game. And I felt so bad that we redid the plot phase.
Uh-huh. Yeah, we talked about this afterwards. I mean, hindsight is 20/20, but I think the way to handle that, if he had gotten confirmation from the judge, was to allow it to happen and to allow Mira to stay in Shadows. Even
probably right.
Play, rather yeah, than redoing a plot phase, because redoing a plot phase is really, really harsh.
Yeah, so I kept my same plot as well, because I had already chosen and I thought that was the right thing to do. So in the end, he managed to come back from that game and win it. And I'm pretty sure that if he had Valored, I'd probably won the game. So it was an interesting play. But Kyle's a really good guy, and I have 100% faith that he wouldn't have made that decision if he hadn't gotten the incorrect information, or at least interpreted the information that Nate gave him in an incorrect manner. So he probably would have won, because he probably would have made the same plot choice that he made. But it was still an interesting game. And anyone that thinks that people at world tournaments don't let people take back things, they do, because Thrones is cool.
John's just too nice.
Take advantage of Dark Nage.
Take advantage of Dark Nage, that's right.
But that was the highlight of my tournament, actually. I think I got good karma after that.
Who was it you lost to in your final match? Or no, you didn't. You finished
No, I finished 4-3. I would have made the 5, but I played basically the same deck you're playing, Alex. And as we had seen the morning before you played it, my deck tends to beat it. But I was sitting across from Dan from New York City, and he looked at his hand before setting up, and he said, "I'm sorry, I will buy you beer for the rest of the night." And I said, "I'm a pretty big drinker. Are you sure?" He's like, "This is really bad for you. And up to $150, you drink on me." And I was like, "Wow, that's very kind of you." And then he set up his whole hand, and I started to cry because he had more mill icons for me for the entire game.
Oh, yeah, it was a horrendous sort of situation. Because afterwards I was asking both Dan and Dave for, you know, any tips on Siege because we're playing similar decks. And he's like, "Okay, so what you want to do is you want to set up all these cards, and you want to have this in hand, and you want to have this, and you want to have this for an ambush from the plains for a golden company, and you have this." I'm like, "That's an awfully specific set of circumstances." And then he turns to Darkaj and goes, "Yeah, it would never happen, would it?" And John's like, "Aww."
Yeah, it was kind of funny, and he was good on his word, so, I mean, props to him.
A lot of free boat races that night?
There was a couple.
I think there's one that was recorded because someone got disqualified for starting early. But I got to see a video of Rick Brannigan drinking, and if it wasn't actually recorded, there's no way I would have believed how fast that man can drink.
He moves his hands and the beers disappear. However, he can't drink more than like 6 beers, so he's all about speed and not about stamina.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I definitely saw some consequences of his ulti stamina.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Yeah, we got some consequences with our roommate as well. So was there any great things outside of the Joust and Melee tournaments that you did at Worlds that you would want to talk about?
Actually,
or funny things?
Did you play the Melee?
I did play in the Melee.
Did you have fun?
Melee is a great game. Yeah, Melee's tough for me because I'm still pretty inexperienced. So, like, having to look at 4 people's board states instead of 2 was just really, really tiring.
Yeah, for sure.
There's so much table talk going on when I'm, like, reading what Long Lances does that I just punished.
You know, you were saying that you practice mainly with, you know, 2 or 3 other people. If you don't actually get to sit down and play Melee to get that table talk, yeah, that can be tough, too. You know, 0 practice in any card game is tough, and it's definitely a different card game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I did get to save Chad Baumgart's Laria Sand with a Sir Dantos.
You had a Sir Dantos Hollard in your deck?
I had a Sir Dantos Hollard in my deck, just in case I wanted to save other people's ladies.
That's awesome.
A strong deck building decision by me. So
when you were envisioning this and you were building your deck, what circumstance were you thinking that you really wanted to save someone else's ladies?
So the original circumstance was because I was playing Stark Siege, which you might approve of or disapprove of. But so there's the, like, I Am No One, that event where you like to kneel a Stark guy if you lose dominance and you get 2 power.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like, man, I can always stand this Sir Dantos if I just claim a lady or someone else does. Even if he's knelt, so I'll always have a standing guy.
And then you realize that Siege can't claim power and dominance?
Well, no, because it puts it on the character. I Am No One, right?
Yes, it does.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah.
I remember the point where my first Siege build in Joust had Winter Festival in it. And I played 2 games, and on the second one, I'm like, I'm at 14 power, and I look at Winter Festival, and then I look at my agenda, and I go, why do I have this plot in my deck?
That's not as good as the Daryl move, though, right?
What is the Daryl move?
He uses the 4-8-1 from Stark.
Oh, the Minstrel's Muse. Yeah. Oh, that's terrible. Oh, it hurts. It hurts.
Now, he said it was a pro play, so.
Just throws everybody off.
The pros can play that and still win, is what he said.
That's not what pro play means.
Yeah, well, it's all up to definition.
Okay, Sam, thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah,
stick around in the community. I think players of your caliber and that clearly enjoyed yourself throughout the tournament are the kind of people we need to keep around. And I'm very much looking forward to seeing your picture on a card.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you'll definitely see me again. Probably not till Gen Con, though.
So I've eagerly been awaiting this episode because I'm wondering whether I get to wear Jacob's large underwear or not.
No. No, you can't wear his large underwear. And I'm sorry to tell you this, Alex. You don't have any of your own.
So this is, I mean, I guess we probably can't for the reason that we were actually running a reset in the deck, even if it wasn't Valor.
Yeah, exactly.
We ran two resets in the deck. Neither of them were Valor.
Yeah. So, I'm pretty sure the two resets mean you're just wearing your regular underwear.
I think it still takes sizable balls to not run Valor.
Oh, Dave, we're not talking about you, because we know you don't wear underwear. I mean...
Fair enough.
I guess probably the best person to tell us the history of this deck, because the first version I saw of it came out of New York. Dave, want to tell us a little bit the history of this Targ Black Sails?
Absolutely. And for those who haven't figured it out, I am still Dave, still Vapad. Happy to be chatting again. So we're talking about the Targ Black Sails deck that Alex and I both played at Worlds. And by the time you're listening to this, JC Waman has played at Stalik. And I built the first version of this deck for the DC regional, or at least before the DC regional, kind of with an eye at playing it maybe there, maybe Gen Con if I could manage to go. I couldn't, but I did play it at the DC regional. And the genesis of it was really, you know, it was an agenda I had fooled with Targ on and off, never to any success because Targ's naval characters are kind of garbagey. But when Daenerys came out, it really changed the game. And the impetus at that point was, how do we break Dany? How do we abuse her? How do we get the most mileage out of the bonkers ability that she had? I tried a bunch of different kinds of builds, a bunch of different agendas. The one that was showing the most promise was a no agenda. You could search for her with summons. And what I really started to find in my games was, if you drew to be a dragon, you won. And if you didn't draw to be a dragon, you lost. So the question then became, well, how do I consistently get to be a dragon? And that's where the idea for Black Sails came. The ability to both search for Dany with a naval plot and search your hold for to be a dragon when you win that naval challenge made the deck really very strong. In the early playtesting and even later in tournament play, the most common comment from an opponent was, oh my god, I can't believe you have another to be a dragon. And, of course, I'm saying you understand that every time I search my hold, I'm looking for one. So that's where it all started. It was a little bit one-dimensional at the time. It really was kind of Artist Seduction was still legal because that was the 10 minutes before the new FAQ at the time came into effect. So it was punch them in the face as hard as you can, turn one with Dany, and use her over and over. Artist Seduction on turn two, you either catch their valor, you prevent them from valoring, fire mid-flesh, and you win. It was a fun deck. It was a great deck. And when Martell No Agenda Venomous played one Gen Con, I was terrified to ever play it again.
My approach to the deck was slightly different. I mean, I'd seen the replacement at DC. Then I went to Canadian Nationals, and two players from New York were playing a version of Targ Black Sails.
They were not
too well. And it performed horribly.
Yeah.
Truly abysmally. Now, partially bad matchups. I mean, the very first matchup I had against it, I was playing Live 2, which completely shut it down.
The deck's extremely weak to Live 2.
So really, I saw this deck and I thought, that's such a cool idea. It didn't do anything against me. Maybe someday I can build something like that that's less awful. And that's sort of what I came to you eventually, because I wasn't very happy with the two decks that I was currently testing for Worlds. And I said, you know, I don't think this deck can win Worlds, but it's the deck I'm having the most fun with. You want to help me tweak it?
And I said no.
And you said no. You said you had something better.
Well, so I was really afraid to play Targ Black Sails, largely, as I said, because of Martell No Agenda. The problem is Targ's naval characters are Potoshi Deckhand, which is one strength, Roin Pullman, which is two strength, and the army. So a Martell Venomous Blade deck, you can't afford the army because they don't have an agenda, and they're killing all your naval weenies. And you'll just never see your hold. And one of the... And
Gaston.
And Gaston, right. So, you know, the deck, as I found it, really lost for one of two reasons and only one of two reasons. Either your To Be a Dragons all got canceled, or you couldn't play them, or you couldn't get into your hold. So against Martell, if it was going to be popular and you weren't going to be able to get into your holds, you were going to be in a lot of trouble. So my idea at the time, Alex, when we started chatting about this, was I had basically converted the deck into a Targ Conquest to Lannister deck, which is the deck that Dan Struhal, Twin-Tuned In, ended up actually playing at Worlds by removing the naval module, throwing the Conquest agenda on, and basically adding three Golden Tooth Mines, Amander, a Janos Slint and a Widow's Wail. Basically, you know, the Lanny draw to fuel the Targ engine. And we played with that deck for a while, and we tested that deck for a while.
We tweaked that deck. We actually got it down to a very nice deck.
It was a very good deck, Dan. Finished in the top 32 at Worlds. Made the cut with a strong, strong day.
It had certain vulnerabilities, and not always the same ones as the Black Sail. It was a little more vulnerable to Greyjoy in general, because the eventual location loss and giving away the prize power turned out to be quite a nasty thing for that deck.
Anything that could steal your Goldtooth Mines was scary.
Yeah, blow up your Goldtooth Mines, give away power at the same time you're losing your draw.
But it wasn't as bad against specifically Liv 2. It wasn't getting shut out of its hold. It had the staying power to play a very long come-from-behind game if necessary.
Yes, it definitely played from behind, because certainly by, you know, the third or fourth round, you're easily draw-capping every turn. Mm-hmm. It was running very high initiative in 3 Bay of Ice in addition to all the Lannister draw and then 2 copies of Jogo.
I don't exactly remember the transition, but I remember that sometime once we'd come close to refining that, I wound up whiffling back with the Black Sails that I thought was more fun, and then we played that Martell No Agenda matchup. I actually managed to beat it. And then
it was very close to Worlds. It was like 4 or 5 days.
Yeah.
It was like the weekend before. Alex and I were just talking and said, this deck is strong, but, man, wasn't the Black Sails more fun? Alex, why was it more fun for you?
Partly because you have more options, but partly, I mean, you are adding triggers. You're replacing things that are passive with triggers that are more interactive. And at one point, I mean, one of my favorite plays of all time testing this deck was something like attack with Magister Illyrio to be a dragon, bring in Danny, trigger Magister Illyrio. Danny's not part of the challenge yet, but I kneel the galley. Give Danny the icon, kneel her, bring her into the challenge, trigger Danny. All of that just off one play, you know, you've completely changed the board state, and that's a lot of fun.
For me, I mean, Black Sails has really become one of my, if not my absolute favorite agenda in the game, just because it gives you so much more knowledge and really rewards, you know, a player who's willing to invest that kind of time to really think about what he's doing. We played a 66-card deck in the end. But because you know exactly what's in your hold, you're playing a very small deck now, a 33-card deck, and you know exactly what's in it. And you can make much more informed decisions knowing that after you've set up 4 cards and redrawn, you've now seen 11 cards already. You've drawn 2 in your draw phase. You're at 13. If you have a Bay of Ice, that's 14. That's well over a third of your deck. And every time you're going to interact with your deck, and every time you're going to go search out from your hold, you just have so much more knowledge about what you can or may be able to do. And those decision trees get very, very interesting, and I think can be very rewarding.
Let's talk about some of the cards in the deck, because I think there's some really interesting interactions. I was privileged enough actually to play test with you guys a bunch of games, and it was a deck that I was going to take if I wasn't so sick, because there is a ton of triggers. But some of the stuff that I thought was really cool was the fact that you could use the fleets, for instance, to reuse Danny, so that you would attack with Danny, you would jump the fleet in a power challenge, you would trigger it to remove her from the challenge. However, her response was already triggered, so you basically got an extra use out of her.
Yeah.
And I know that when I was playing for fun against Ray Atkinson, I did that, and he went, oh, that's nice. And I said, yeah, that, you know, that was a Vapad inspiration.
That was very similar to the, I mean, if we cast our minds back to the Greyjoy Black Sails that we built for Gen Con last year, one of the very fun plays in that deck was using the fleet from Pike to stand Wex Pike.
Yes.
And essentially get 2 unopposed challenges out of him, because you can reuse him again.
Yeah.
Those fleets are always deceptively powerful.
Yeah, but there was other great plays, like the Gold Company. Just multi-using the Gold Company to get those Ambush from the Plains, those other key events back.
John, that was your card, so you get all
that
the
That was my one card, my Gold Company.
Yeah, I mean, having the standard play was to open with King's Landing Coup, which was 4/8/1. So you've got 3 Ambush from the Plains in the deck, and to be able to Ambush from the Plains the Golden Company is the only card in your discard pile. You win a challenge, you get it back. You then, maybe you're fortunate enough to ambush the Long Lances, stand the Golden Company, attack with the Golden Company again, get the same ambush from the Flames back. It puts you so far ahead of the curve in the early game. And even if it's not first turn, you know, so say it's the first 2-3 turns, the only cards in your discard pile are strong events. I mean, maybe you're getting a C back, but It's not likely.
Good. Yeah. One thing I really liked about the Golden Company is it meshed in with a theme that had to be run in this deck. So we had to run a lot of uniques, not just for Marine Turning Grounds. That was a fortunate coincidence. But because it's the only way we could access our hold reliably. Targ naval characters are awful.
Yeah.
And so we were forced to include a bad card. Different bad cards, because the Pentoshi deckhands, they played out better than I expected, but they're still a bad card. But the Dagger Lake Galley is the one I'm specifically referring to.
And we played three of them.
And that interacts with uniques as well. So our deck was heavily slanted towards uniques, and being able to use the Marine Turning Grounds and the Golden Company to key off that, I think, is again all these themes coming together in a very, very tight-knit package.
And the Marine Turning Grounds is something I want to highlight. And not only that, but the burn module in general.
I agree. Yeah,
Something that was missing from my DC regional deck. You know, Dan called that deck one-dimensional, and he was right, because the only burn was I forget if it was one or two copies of Flamekiss, but that was all. And being able to add a burn module for some pretty hefty control, it was two Turning Grounds, two Flamekiss, and Incinerate, Illyrio, and three Dragon Knights was a substantial amount of challenge phase control.
Oh, hold on. Three Dragon Knights?
That's right. I forgot. And how could I forget? Alex and I ran 65 cards in common and one card different. I ran three Dragon Knights. Alex opted to drop one Dragon Knight for one Horseback Archer. And because he did beat me in Swiss, I do have to acknowledge that his deck was better.
And that's what we agreed upon.
That's what we agreed upon when we started the Swiss.
It's round. Worth noting that the Horseback Archers did show up. I drew them. They got discarded to an intrigue challenge, so they were never useful. But
before we go too far, though,
the burn module was important.
Right. Can we talk about the decision to go with the two Flamekiss, one Incinerate instead of the three Flamekiss? Because a lot of people look at that and go, why didn't you just run another Flamekiss? You're not going to have enough allies, really, to get more than two or three, you know, strength reduction from the Flamekiss.
I think in the end there might have actually even been more mercenaries than allies, because the fleets and the Golden Company were all mercenaries. But yes, that was a decision that I proposed very late in the game. We're now like a day or two before Worlds. And it was really just because there are some things that are no attachments, and there are some things that are a pain that are no attachments.
Sam.
Like Sam, which I tried to Flamekiss in a test game against John. And he said, Sam's no attachment. And I said, wow, I've been cheating for 2 years.
The same thing happened. So after you guys mentioned that to me, I'm pretty sure that I had played like three test matches in which I'd Flamekissed Sam.
Yeah.
And just sitting there going, oh, dear.
But Sam wasn't even one of the impact cards we were looking at. I mean, an opponent's Aegon Targaryen. And Alaris, a Preston Greenfield.
Preston, yeah.
Important characters you may have to get off the board. And, you know, we consciously did not make our deck toolboxy with 1x answers. But at the point where Flamekiss and Incinerate are somewhat redundant in that they're going to burn in this 2-3 strength range, and you can potentially search for the Incinerate if that's the one that you need. And if it's in your deck with 33 cards, you'll probably draw it. It seemed like a good 1x.
So did you have any storied matchups that you'd specifically want to share, Dave?
From Worlds, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, at some point we should talk about our mirror match. But before we get there, let me just think about one of the cards in the deck that I didn't really like all that much, but it seemed like a necessary evil, was Battle for the Shield Islands. It's not often high impact, but when it is very high impact. And in my first match in Swiss, actually, I played Chad Jamnik, and he set up a Land of the Iron Throne. It's going to be a pain the entire game. So it was the only time ever I won the Naval Challenge, and I searched for it for the Battle for the Shield Islands. It was in my hold. I played it in the plot phase round two. I stole his Iron Throne, and the game ended very quickly after that.
I actually had that card win me a game as well. My match against Dan Struhal, I played a lot of Targ on my way up, but against Dan's Targ Conquest Lanny, I wound up drawing into it. I wouldn't have searched for it, but I played that. We each got a challenge off. He took my Meraxes and I took his Mander, and the next two plots we were each forced to flip were the Aftermath. So yeah. I got four cards out of that, and he only got two out of my Meraxes, and I think it made a very big difference
Wow, yeah.
For that match. So,
I also played a great game against Chris Kaiser from Tulsa. He was playing Vera. I believe it was No Agenda, and it was just a very hard fought competitive game the whole way. One of the games I think my most enjoyed games over the past year plus. I eventually got him. We went to time, but I did end up with 15 power. It wasn't a whole lot of plots. We maybe went 5 or 6, but we certainly didn't wrap around. But it was a very cerebral, a very well fought game. Chris was an excellent player, and really I felt pushed the limits of what the deck was doing.
I suppose I should tell the matchup of the one I was really afraid of, which was Siege. I knew I was going to be playing against the Siege in the top 16 matchup. I had to sleep on it, which I wasn't able to do at all. And then got up in the morning, and John was playing a Siege deck the day before, so he had one built. So we went down to the breakfast table and essentially tested this matchup 6 times, and I lost 5 out of 6. And every time I'd get one of the tools that I knew I needed, Pyot Pre, he'd play Cold Hands, boom, Pyot's gone. There goes my answer. Play Danny. Oh, Borderlands Keep hits the board. God damn it. There's going to be a hard turn one.
You mean Northlands Keep?
Northlands Keep. And it just went against me every single time. But when I actually came to play the match, I drew basically perfectly. I was able to threat from the north turn one. I had enough to burn out his entire board on that first turn. And then I just crushed. But man, was I terrified of that matchup.
Wow. Yeah, because I think it has been a really bad matchup for your. Yeah.
Was that your only loss in the Swiss?
No. Lauren from Boston got me with Bera Dark Wings as well in the seventh round. The game actually turned on a very early Seductive Promise. First round, I believe, she took my Roin Pullman. And was able to keep me out of my hold early, my hold which contains my Viserys and all 3 of my Dragon Knights, Dragon Thieves. It seems like such an innocuous thing, a Seductive Promise. She happened to draw it early and absolutely took the right character with it. And that put me on my back foot the whole game.
So my advice for anyone who wants to play this deck is to do like I did. And in 9 matches, I think I set up a Bay of Ice in 7.
Yes.
I think that's a really good strategy. I think setting up a Bay of Ice
is winning.
That's a very good play.
Bay of Ice turned out to be, in my opinion, the most important card in the deck, because the difference between drawing 3 from the beginning and drawing 2 from the beginning was just huge. And we went back and forth. We argued over this a good bit in the tweaking.
On the wrong side.
Do we cut to 2? We need a slot for something else. But, when we sat down for our mirror match, I think we both agreed before it started, whoever sees his Bay of Ice first is going to win. And that ended up being you. I took a huge gamble. I do want to tell the story of this mirror match. You set up your Bay of Ice. I did not set up a Bay of Ice. And I set up a Street of Silk and something that didn't really matter. I opened with Betrayal at the Wall to win initiative. I countered my 1 gold. I dropped 2 C's. I knelt them. I flame kissed something, maybe a Roin Pullman. I discarded the C's, both of them, to pay 4 to drop a fleet. And then knelt my Street of Silk and paid 1 gold to play a Danny. And just tried to punch you in the face hard enough that you would not be able to recover. But the cost of that was not playing my King's Landing coup, so I couldn't get my To Be a Dragon's working. And because of the pressure that you were able to kind of come back with, I always had to play a different plot every plot phase after that. And was never able to get my To Be a Dragon's working, and you won the long game.
It was, I tested a similar match as well, and against the Tarkov Westlandian testing, and with John. And my decision had mostly been, I needed To Be a Dragons, I needed them early, because they were more variance resilient than trying to burn me out early. So you made the call of getting that extra draw offline and completely wiping my board basically first turn, and I said, I'm going to play the 4-8-1, and my To Be a Dragons are going to start working at least a turn before yours, probably 2 or 3, because I can control initiative at that point.
Yep. And that ended up working out well. But the Bay of Ice just underscores, though, kind of how important that card was to the match. And in Black Sails in particular, the ability to know how many copies of your Bay of Ice are in your 33 card can really inform your mulligan. I mean, I tossed away a 6-card setup at one point because all 3 copies were in my 33 card deck and I didn't see one.
I did exactly the same thing. The first thing I did was count the number of Bay of Ice in my hold.
Count the number of Bays, you count your Dannys, you count your Tibis, and you kind of go from there. So, Bay of Ice. That was big.
It was. The match I lost, I think I may have set up a Bay of Ice on the match I lost, but it was the only match I lost, and I lost it through a mistake of my own that I shall continue to kick myself for decades to come. I don't think I mentioned it on the cast, but I had a really strong early game, high pressure against Lanny Darkwing Dark, where it's the eventual champion Sam Bratz, and was in the middle of a power challenge. I jumped the fleet in. He says it's unopposed. And then so I move through the steps and begin to take the power, and then I say I'm looking through my hold. He says, hold on a second. And it's true, I had rushed through a couple of steps there, so he's thinking about what he can do. And as a Magic player, he has this tick where he flicks his cards around. I'm used to playing on Octagon. Excuses, but you know, I tend to, on Octagon, I will flag a trigger that I need to do by shift-clicking on it and things like that. But anyway, so he thinks about his options for 3-4 minutes there. And then he goes, no, never mind. And so we move on to dominance, assigned dominance. And, I had already picked the Tevia Dragon. It was at the bottom of my hold. I had already put it there, and I didn't get it. And I knew he was Valoring. I played the right plot for that, King's Law. He had a card in Shadows. He lost his Qyburn, et cetera. You know, I knew exactly what was happening, but not having that Tevia Dragon that turn just really made a huge, huge difference and allowed him to put the pressure and the card draw to just weigh against me from the rivers over the next 2 turns.
It's a rough way to go out.
Also, he managed to play the 2/5/2 river to discard the... I had 1 Tevia Dragon in my hold and 2 in my deck, so I was fairly convinced I was going to draw one eventually.
And he popped it.
And he popped the 2/5/2. it's random, and it doesn't matter whether it's at the bottom of my deck or it's the one that's...
Of course not, but it's
demoralizing.
It still hurts, though.
Tevia Dragon, I would have drawn it.
I once popped an opponent's Dark Star off the top of his deck with that, with the 2/5/2 river. That was annoying. So are there any changes you'd make to this deck if you were to field it again? Do you think this was... Well, those are separate questions. Go ahead. Let me ask that question first.
Changes that I make to the deck. I think there are a couple of...
You dropped the Horseback Archers for a 3rd Dragon deck, right?
Nah. I like the Horseback Archers. He missed me a 2nd draw off Jogo a couple of times.
He's really good against Siege. Like
that too.
Yeah,
really good.
As the monocon as well, at 3 strength. There are many meta-dependent calls that I would think of. So, for instance, King's Law was a meta call. I faced 2 Dragon Pits. It was great for me. The 9 initiative was very important. Discarding Quiver and things like that was quite handy. But I could see running a couple more Shadows cards, maybe even the Smugglers, although I'm not convinced on them, but things like Jamie.
Terrible.
Jamie Lannister's not bad in this deck.
Sure.
And things like that, but I wouldn't run those with King's Law. If I expected a lot more 2-cost locations that were going to cause me problems, I could see running another city in there to be able to extend a city besiege so it's not just hitting Northland Keeps and Gas and Gray, but it is in fact hitting some of the other bigger...
Bitterbridge.
Bitterbridge is another important one. The character base, I don't think I would change unless I was changing the plots, getting rid of King's Law, then I might play around with it a little bit. Might even add Pyromancer's Apprentice, maybe, if I really felt I needed the location hate. But that's pretty much it. I think if I'm not touching the plots, I'm not touching the deck.
I agree with you that that King's Law is probably... And depending on how you feel about locations in the meta, City Besiege potentially... I mean, City Besiege was important because, really, of the 3 one-cost locations we mentioned, Bitterbridge, Gaston Grey, and Northland Keep, all give the deck all sorts of headaches because they all just shut down Danny by themselves. So City Besiege with the 1 other city, King's Landing Coup, it was just an easy, quick, on-demand solution to those 1-cost locations that were problematic. But if for some reason those cards weren't being played, you weren't worried about those cards, you could find a differently impactful card for that slot as well as King's Law.
I don't know. I kind of feel like the City Besieged has to stay, not because of a meta call, but because that card got me the overall championship played by somebody else. played by Aoria. I don't know if I've specifically mentioned this match. Did you guys both watch Aoria's match against the French champion, Gaëlle Boigny?
I didn't catch all of it.
I mentioned in the interview FFG had with me that, you know, I owe Aoria the title that I got. And, you know, winning by a point in overall and the way they score it, you know, there's no doubt that it's a fishy title, and Gaëlle was an excellent player all day and plays very well. But the plays by Aoria in that last turn were just – they highlight how great of a player he is as well.
He is an excellent player.
I mean, everybody knew that – Gaëlle had to flip Melisandre's schemes that turn. He had to. There was absolutely no doubt. And so everybody sitting next to me goes, well, Aoria has to flip the 3-6-1 Cersei scheme. He has to take initiative and be able to kneel out a couple of things that show up. And before that even happens, the French champion triggers as a shy initiate and says, I'm going to take Melisandre and put her in my discard pile and discard two cards from my deck. And Aoria looks at it, and everybody around goes, oh, he's going to cancel it with Iron Throne. And he looks at that discard pile, and he says, okay. And everybody around me goes, why is he doing this? Why is he doing this? And I have to think about it for a second, and I go, it's because he doesn't want Dale to come out. Mm-hmm. If Dale comes out, then a Seat of Power comes out, and then something else comes out, and then, you know, you've got even more of a board presence. And then so he's about to flip plots, and everybody's flipping plots, and he flips City Besieged. And nobody sees this coming. And he nukes the only reducer that Gaëlle has on the board, the Street of Silk. And suddenly Gaëlle is left with only 4 gold to pull stuff out of his hold. All he can pull is Melisandre and 2 Royal Entourages.
And it gets even better because Aoria already has ways of discarding allies in his hand,
exactly.
Which makes the play even better because now he's just destroying that board presence.
So, man, hats off, Alvaro.
It's just stellar play. And, you know, that game was weird. Alvaro was starting very much from behind. Gaëlle drew into some, bad stuff for a couple of turns. It was a very, very tight match at the end. But those are examples of plays that everybody around, backseat driving, was saying, do something else. And he's in the heat of the moment at the table. He doesn't have that luxury, and he makes a better call. So City Besieged won me the overall.
All right, keep
it in the deck.
All right, so we'll keep it. That's really the only change that I think I would make. I do want to say that I think the deck was a bit of a meta call. I think had we been expecting Heavy Siege, had we been expecting a lot of Greyjoy, you know, this deck does have its natural predators that it will suffer to. Mm-hmm.
HODLIV2 hurts this one pretty badly.
So hard. All forms of Greyjoy, I'm not sure there's any Greyjoy that is a plus matchup. At best, there might be some that are 50-50s, Agenda and a Kings of Winter maybe. But I think we were right.
Kings of Winter's rough because you wind up ambush puts cards back
hand. And 50-50 at best.
Yeah.
So I think we were right in our meta call that we weren't going to see a lot of that. I haven't seen the stats from Worlds. Maybe we both just got lucky in our draws. I didn't play any Greyjoy.
I didn't play any Greyjoy. I played 4 Targ, 2 Stark, 2 Lanny, or for the top of Swiss, I played a Martell.
John, you said you played some Greyjoy?
Yeah, I played a Black Sails, my very first game, and I know that a couple of the Ottawa guys actually brought Greyjoy as well, did 5-2.
Okay.
Sean, who shared our room, played a Greyjoy deck that was mostly built by Raul that I know he's taking to Shalik.
Not say much about that.
Post-Dalek.
That deck is evil.
That deck is super evil.
That deck is pure evil.
Very low character count, a wall deck using Maiden's Bane and a bunch of stuff to stand Maiden's Bane and defend challenges.
Oh, but it's so fun to battle.
And out-of-house frozen outposts and the task plot to find Aegon's Hill.
Oh, yeah, so all to use it with Great Wick.
That deck was ridiculous. We tested the Conquest, the Lanny Hard Conquest Lanny version against that deck, just on the off chance that someone else had thought of something similar. And, oh, man, that was just painful.
Yeah, it was an auto loss to the
absolutely.
Tark.
Absolutely. I mean,
the Black Sails had a better chance because of the Battle for Shield Islands,
yes,
which can buy you two turns.
Maybe.
You take the Maiden's Bane because you can't trigger
any.
Hope
he doesn't North either newly made Lord it and then play another one.
Well, right, it's probably duped, so now he's got to do it twice.
That's but it's mostly because he can't trigger anything during that phase, so you can also probably get a search in your hold during that epic battle, even if you couldn't get one during the regular phase.
A couple of the things I just want to note about the deck that people may, you know, I'm sure will have questions upon seeing the list. We do only have one measly copy of Refugee of the Plains. Just
actually,
one.
There are a lot of auto-includes that we either didn't include or had fewer copies of.
Yeah. That one refugee made it in because, I mean, for me at least, we had, I think, 13 zero-cost cards without it, and I wanted 14. And we needed one more character, so that was fine. But, you know, those came out to make room for things like Dragon Knights and Horseback Archers. We played the Princes of the Sun, Jorah Mormont, the 2-cost, 3-strength Tricon Stealth, instead of the ally one. And I know a lot of people, and James and I had talked about this at length, about running kind of 1x toolboxy cards, the ally discard Jorah, the Dario that matches him, a Ygritte, a Bastard here and there. We very much took the tack, guys, of not making it that kind of deck. We cut this down to as lean a deck as we could at 66 cards so that really every card you drew was always good. And I think that was one of the features of the deck that really shines throughout the course of my tournament. Mm-hmm. What other auto includes are there that you don't think that we hit on? Those were the two kind of question marks that I would have if I looked at this list.
Auto includes that we didn't hit on. We didn't have a second copy of Jogal, who's quite normal in Targ decks.
Mm-hmm.
We're definitely, it looks like Archmaester Marwyn is a perfect fit for this deck, but in the end, he wasn't worth it either.
Wasn't super impactful. We did test him.
We did. What are some other Targ auto includes? Yeah, I guess Jorah and Dario tend to be quite common, but they weren't the right fit for this deck.
I would have loved the 4-cost Viserion, but he just hurt the curve too much.
Yeah, we tried him.
And the Mad King as well. Okay. The Mad King ended up being kind of like a win more card in this deck.
Yeah.
He wasn't going to help you out of a tough spot if you were behind, and if you were winning, you were already winning. The other interesting thing is we have zero neutral characters in this deck.
That was a conscious decision. At one point, you had wanted to include a Zolo, and I said, I don't want to give anything that makes my opponent Idris better. I play Greyjoy a lot, and I am extremely hesitant to include that first ally. Even though there are good allies in Greyjoy, if I can build a deck with none of them, that's better. It make an opponent's card dead. And I had the same sort of idea for neutral cards. If I can avoid them entirely, then Ygritte is suddenly a bad 3-for-2.
And it's important to note also that Tibia Dragons won't work with your neutrals. I had situations when testing the earlier version of the deck where I have the Tibia Dragon in my hand. All I need is a character. I know I've got characters left, and the one that I draw is that neutral smuggler. And I just say, wow, I can't play my events.
And Incinerate also counts only Targ characters as well. So.
Yep.
Well, I have a question for you guys. You talked about decks, you know, cards that you wanted to get in but the side weren't good. What was your favorite card in the deck, other than Danny?
We said Bay of Ice.
Okay, other than Bay of Ice. Go again.
What is our third favorite card in the deck?
yeah. What's your third favorite card in the deck?
Bay of Ice doesn't make my favorites list. Bay of Ice, I thought was the most important card in the deck.
Yeah, what was your favorite?
So not including Danny, who's amazing and is all that fun.
Just you can include Danny. What was your favorite card in the deck?
I'm going to have to actually say Pyat Pri. It's an odd choice because he doesn't do anything special in this deck that he doesn't do in any other deck. He doesn't interact with Black Sails well, but he did what Danny does, and he did it against Siege, and he did it against Martell, and he killed a Viper, and he just in the tournament he did the best you can possibly imagine for him.
I'm going to pick our restricted card and say the Long Lances. Long Lances just, I think, even more than Danny, make this deck work. Long Lances is card advantage. Anytime you can use this to one character twice, you've gained card advantage for that round. And with being able to search not only Long Lances, but the pieces, I mean, Targ Targ in general is combo, right? Not necessarily game-breaking, you know, river standing brand, repeatable victory condition achieving combo, but little two-card combos, little three-card combos that together are greater than the sum of their parts. So the magic of Black Sails is you draw one piece of your two-piece combo and you go search for the other. And Long Lances is such a big part of all of that, being able to reuse these good cards over and over off of things like Horseback Archers, things like a Dragon Thief, things like Into the Dragon.
Did you say Horseback Archers? Because you didn't have those in your deck.
I was speaking for both of us and acknowledging that that Alex made an excellent choice in including one copy.
66 Dave, there was something you specifically told me about the Pentoshi deckhands that I think bears
the Pentoshi. So the Pentoshi deckhands has an ability and no one knows what it does. It says after you declare Pentoshi deckhands as a naval attacker, response, after you declare as a naval attacker, reduce the cost of the next card that you ambush this phase by one. And that is something that doesn't often come up. But I find is always worth triggering. It didn't happen this tournament, but I have had happen.
Twice.
Didn't happen to me, but in other tournaments and in other play, I have triggered the Pentoshi deckhands with zero ambush characters in my hand and had them cancel it with Harrenhal, kill a guy. Just looking at my board, I'm looking down, I say, okay, let's see, Long Lances cost three, I have two influence standing. I'll trigger the Pentoshi deckhands. And they go, oh. To influence standing, oh, man, Long Lance. All right, I'll kill this guy and cancel it.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened.
That's even better than actually having the effect resolve and ambushing a Long Lances for two, which I did do. I did actually trigger the response a few times and then have, you know, a cheap Dragon Thief or a cheaper Long Lances. But having it canceled via Harrenhal when you're completely bluffing is wonderful.
I'm gonna miss Black Sails.
Yeah,
this year's been down the road. I had a lot of success with it at Gen Con last year in Greyjoy. I had a lot of fun with it and a lot of success with it this year.
Yeah, you're going to miss it right until the point where you get the new cards and you open up the pack for the first time.
First card will be called Black Sails, a champion card designed by Alex Hein.
So that's the deck. John, do you have any other thoughts on it? I know you didn't play it, but you were certainly heavily involved in the late testing.
I think you guys covered it all. I think one of the people that we did forget to mention, you know, we mentioned that he's going to play it, but James had a hand in the deck as well, right, as well as Dan, since they were testing it and talking about it and helped a lot. So I think it's important to recognize them.
James is actually another one I credit with actually having us play it, because James kept coming back to me. So after the DC Regional, I basically talked him through it, said this is what the deck does. I didn't give him a list. He wanted to build his own anyway. But, I kind of talked him through the main pieces, and he built his list, and he would show it to me, and I'd say, well, I didn't do this, and we argued back and forth over the merits of this and that. But it was that in large part that got me thinking about it again. And he would say, you know, are you going to play this at Worlds? And I'd say, no, no, no. And he said, you know, I'm still finding it really strong. And then he played it in a tournament in England to great success. I think he made the final four with it. And I'm not sure I would have revisited it had he not pushed me on that. And Dan, of course, as well. Dan Struhal tested with us and helped us refine the end of the Conquest version. And then, of course, we converted it back. But that was really, it was largely the same deck, the Lamy module for the Naval module.
Yeah, basically had two mirror matches.
Yeah. So that's the deck. I hope you guys enjoy it. We'll obviously be posting the list up along with the episode.
Great. Well, thank you very much for testing with us, for building, well, for letting us build with you as well.
Oh, my pleasure.
It really was fun. Well, so I'm sure we'll be building with you in the future.
I certainly hope so.
Closing comments. What do we have? We have, all right, the first thing that I want to mention, because Dave Strom's Vapad will kill me if I don't, is that this weekend, the 29th, I believe, that's Saturday, is Red Saturday. That's the New York City tournament. This is going to be a great event. They've already got more than, I think, 34 or 35 confirmed registrants for this tournament. This is people tend not to play the same deck they played at Worlds or the just one Stalic or whatever. They play something a little more interesting. It's not a Tier 2 tournament by any means, but I think it's a really good way to wind down the organized play season for the year. The prize support is phenomenal. New York
is phenomenal.
Yeah, the alt art we got to see at Worlds, and it's just stellar. So I hope that if you were on the fence about that, strongly consider going to that. I think that's a wonderful way to end the organized play season in North America. But if you're further afield, New York's not a possibility. There are still two Octagon tournaments. The sign-up for league play ends this week, I believe, or within a week or so of this episode airing. And the Driver Not the Car tournament, I think, starts in January. I haven't double-checked the sign-ups. I really should. My apologies to listeners for not having double-checked that.
But there is a reason that we'll be taking a break soon, because we're really busy.
Yeah. Turns out holiday season, yeah, it's it's busier every year. So this is our before-last episode. Our last episode will be next week. It will be entirely dedicated to Stalic, enormous tournament, hopefully with guests from that tournament. We've got a couple of people approach us already, so I'm looking forward to that. I think that's a great way to close off the season. I am also cautiously optimistic about us getting a version of the Liney Dark Wings Dark Words that was played at Worlds by Sam Bratz. I think DC wants to hold on to that until after New York, just so people aren't playing that in New York as well.
Mm-hmm. Which is fine. I mean, I think people are going to be taking a small break, too. I'm sure they want to see it, but I don't know if it's going to be the end of the world if they have to wait a week before they do.
All right. And do you have anything else for closing comments, John?
I do not.
Well, then that's everything.
Thank you for listening to Beyond the Wall. If you have any comments or would like to be featured on the cast, please let us know by email at beyondthewallpodcast@gmail.com or through Facebook at Beyond the Wall Podcast. If you've enjoyed the music, check out more of Antti Martikainen's work at the link embedded in the chapter data. See you all next week. We'll